netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
FX Guide is proudly sponsored by SIGGRAPH Asia. FX Podcast is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia, this year being held in Hong Kong, December 12th to 15th. For more information, go to siggraph.org/asia2011.
Hi, and welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm Mike Seymour, and today we're going to be, well, I'm joined by Jeff Huser. How are you, Jeff?
Hey, Mike. Very good. Thanks.
So, Jeff, this is an interview that you've done. I'm really here just to introduce it, but I guess also to, I guess, ask a fundamental question, which is you've been handling the labor relations side of the coverage we've had here at FX Guide, and you've been the one that's primarily been leading the charge because you're obviously based in California, which is where a lot of this action's at. As an outsider looking in, has anything advanced? Has anything changed in the last year? Where are we at?
No, I would say absolutely nothing's advanced. It's really frustrating. And I think that I'm really frustrated. I've really tried to stay on the fence of this whole thing and tried to be kind of that neutral journalist thing. And then, you know, at IBC, I was talking to one of the artists over there, and we got talking about some stuff. And, you know, so much of the business is the same no matter where you do it. And then they were like, yeah, but, you know, at least we have healthcare and 30 days vacation and stuff like that. And I just started thinking to myself, you know, all the different things that people talk about in the U.S. and the problems I hear. I talked to an artist today who has been strung along, has not been paid for a job that they completed in July.
Wow.
Yeah. And we're recording this in December. And I talked to another artist who's just been really stymied at every turn trying to get copies of their work, you know, for their demo reel. Like literally has pretty much been told they're not going to get it. And it's like, well, okay. I mean, so it's just really frustrating. And so I've kind of, you know, you might hear some overtones of me in this podcast breaking that journalism type wall and being more proactive. Part of that was to get Tom to open up about some stuff. But I just really can't understand how what we have now can be continued. I mean, it just doesn't seem sustainable to me. It's definitely not working for most people in the freelance world. And I haven't heard any solutions that are really viable. So I'm really puzzled as to why the union has refused to do a podcast with us still to this day. So this podcast actually started because I noticed that the Art Directors Guild, which had put up a website focused on previs artists, which we talked to Tom Walsh about in a previous podcast back in April. If you just Google Tom Walsh FX Guide, WALSH, or if you go to our site and just enter the search box, Tom Walsh, you'll find that podcast. And I'll link to it in this story, in this podcast as well, in the related links. But we talked to him about that back then, but then they mentioned that they were going after matte paintings. And I mentioned Twitter.
For just for people that didn't hear that, Tom Walsh is actually the president of the Art Directors Guild, right?
I'm so sorry. Yes, Tom Walsh is the president of the Art Directors Guild. And the Art Directors Guild, you know, represents a ton of crafts going back over, you know, lots and lots of years. But as you'll hear in the podcast, he freely admits that they dropped the ball, that they kind of got comfortable and kind of weren't really paying attention as the world kind of changed around them. And they feel that previs and matte paintings and a few other things definitely fall within their purview, and they want to encourage artists to, you know, get what's they feel is due to them through this, through the union contracts, you know, portable benefits and retirement accounts and things like that. And you know, when you talk, the thing that really frustrates me is I hear a lot of people throwing out different ideas and different alternative ideas and things like that. And trade association, Scott Ross, bless him, has been really trying to get something going there, but that's really hit no traction. But do you hear production crews bitching about being in the union? I mean, that's the thing that always puzzles me is I talk to people that are in the union that are very happy, and they're happy that they have these benefits. And I hear these great stories from people about, you know, getting to a certain age and going, oh, wait, I have all this money in this retirement account. I didn't even know it was there, because it's just that's the way things are supposed to work.
Okay, so now, just again, because I'm an outsider, let me just see if I got this right. So the Art Directors Guild, if I remember from your previous podcast, is a local union, and it's part of IATSE.
It's a national union, yes.
But it's part of IATSE, right? Which is, when I say local, I mean your American thing.
Yes, right. So, yes.
Yeah. And it's, and IATSE is basically just the sort of the mega union, as it were.
Yeah, the IATSE represents, you know, editors, cinematographers. It's basically everybody's in IATSE, except unless the actors, which are in SAG. There's IBEW, but they tend to cover different areas than what we would think of as normal. They tend to be more of electricians, and it's more like everything outside the soundstage, I guess, is the way I've heard it described.
Okay, so if I was wanting to become part of what I would call the film industry's union, I would some way or other end up in IATSE, but the question is which bit I would come in under. Is that right? Because, I mean, art director seems like an odd thing for VFX artists to be in.
Well, and that's the problem. And that's why, you know, when I posted the thing about the matte painters, Paul Franklin, a frequent guest of our podcast from Double Negative, said, what industry are these people talking about that matte paintings aren't done in visual effects? Because that's now part and parcel of what we do. I mean, there isn't a shot we touch anymore that isn't heavily reconstructed and backgrounds extended, and, you know, the lines are definitely, and Tom and I talk about that, the lines are so blurred these days about what, where one thing begins and another thing ends, even previs. I mean, it's all very interwoven, and I'm not sure the unions have really still woken up to how complex it is. The thing that drives me crazy is, from the union standpoint, looking at visual effects artists, if you were to go around and add up all the visual effects artists in Los Angeles and San Francisco, that's a lot of people.
Yes.
I mean, you would think that you would dwarf your crews.
Yeah. But is that not a problem in of itself? I think you and I have discussed this over a drink once before, that some of the unions were a little worried that if they had the visual effects artists join, that they would literally swamp their traditional membership and then obviously be able to vote for, like, a visual effects biased kind of agenda. Is that not, or is it my imagining that?
No, that's absolutely true. We've talked about that. I mean, that was one of the things I heard, was that, you know, one of the reasons that you're not seeing, that people are perceiving that you're not seeing some of the unions going aggressively after, we want to just go after visual effects. Two reasons. First of all, it would swamp, and, you know, give it 2 years and we would swamp their membership with the amount of people we'd have, and end up taking over the union, I guess, is the fear. The second thing is that IATSE has announced that they want to set up a separate visual effects branch, which, of course, as we know, they say that, and they have done very little about that. So,
okay, so I have at the moment the choice of either A, getting into IATSE when the cows come home and they have a visual effects union, B, if I happen to be in one of these outlier areas, I could perhaps get into the Art Directors Guild. Is there another option?
Well, and this is, I mean, right now the main guilds that affect our area are the Animation Guild and the Art Directors Guild. And, you know, where do you stop the line on animation? I mean, what is animation? I mean, they represent DreamWorks people right now and a few other people. I can't think off the top of my head, but, you know, what do they do?
Because it does make... I mean, it would make sense that a third option that was VFX would sit nicely between art direction. Because, I mean, in my world, there are three, you know, distinctive things there. There are, like, animated films that are fully animated. And, yes, there's overlap. There's VFX. And then there's art direction, the art department. And art department are nice guys. We like them. But, you know, they really do seem separate. And so I guess... Do you think that this latest move... I guess we have to talk to Tom, but this latest move reflects IATSE moving away from that idea of a VFX union for just VFX, or is it just really too hard to tell?
I don't get that sense at all. I get the sense that they just say, wait a minute, this is what we do. You know, we have jurisdiction over this, and we understand that there's not an art department right now doing matte paintings necessarily, but that we want to make sure that people know that if they're doing matte paintings, that technically they can be covered by the animation by the Art Directors Guild, and they should be, is what their point is. So, complicated. I mean, the thing that makes me nuts is, and I mentioned this to Tom in the podcast. You know, everybody kind of has this idea, I think, that people are just going to line up and vote and turn in their cards, then there'll be a vote, and boom, the union happens. And, you know, in talking to some people about, like, well, how does this really happen? And probably the most recent example is The Biggest Loser, the reality show. People have
I'm waiting to see how this connects up.
Well, the crew there wanted to become union. Yeah. They wanted to become union after being non-union for... There were a lot of union people that had been working on the show for years, is what I understand, and they weren't getting their benefits. They weren't putting in enough hours. to maintain their union status is what was happening. So they were in danger of losing their health care and things like that. And, you know, they talked to the producers and the producers said no. So they ended up having to go out on strike. And that's the point that I think people are missing is IATSE not only has to get people informed and on board with this, they have to get them riled up enough that they're willing to say, yeah, we're going to walk out on this job and, you know, till they come around and give us a union contract. That's where we are. I mean, that's the part nobody talks about. But okay, the fact so is they're not talking about anything, so it's kind of hard to say that. But
well, there's a couple of other related issues. One is, and I know this isn't covered today, but maybe in the future we can explore this. There's this whole thing around Andy Serkis and being up for an acting Oscar. And, you know, where does that leave the animators? Which I think the only reason that's related to unions is that that wouldn't be a question that would be so open in public if there was an organization that was answering that, or that spoke strongly the way the directors guilds or the actors equity or whatever.
Right. I have been following speak. That so closely. I've just been following it a lot on the internet, and I've seen really strongly written opinions one way and really strongly written opinions the other way. And I just don't know. I mean,
the second one I was going to say is that if that's, you know, a kind of an issue to one side that's kind of interest, the other thing that's on the edge of this also is the VES, who, you know, came out with VES Mark II, which said basically we're no longer going to be your father's old VES. We're going to be the brand new spanking proactive, hey, we're going to look after you VES. And has that progressed?
Not publicly. I've heard through the grapevine that they are doing things and trying to make things happen. But, you know, I mentioned this to Tom in the podcast. Go to the VES website today, right now, and try to find the Bill of Rights.
Right.
They're not there. I can't find them.
Right. And you're a member, of course, so you get membership access.
Yeah. But, I mean, they should be on the front page somewhere, you would think. They're at least easy to find. I ended up finding them by searching our site. We had a copy of them there. I think the reality, in my opinion, is that people can do all sorts of things. They can put together associations. They can put together whatever they want to do. Without the power of collective bargaining, I just think they're societies. And I don't think that's, I mean, whatever it takes to get people to talk. But I do think that the only thing that we can have this conversation for the next 10 years, but until somebody actually embraces the idea of collective bargaining, I don't see anything changing in any of this. None of it.
Which I guess begs the question that if we run the clock forward to 2012, do you think that we will see some kind of organized representation of the rights of individuals, especially in America? Because obviously, I mean, I've got to say, as an outsider, some of this stuff is incredibly peculiar, not least of which is, of course, in my country, the idea that your employer has any say in your health care or your health plan. It seems like such an invasion of privacy and ridiculous kind of overstepping of their role in my life has to be absurd in the extreme.
I couldn't agree more.
But, I mean, do you think in 2012 we're going to be any different than we are tonight? Do you feel that there's hope?
Well,
you personally, speaking just as usual?
I don't know. I mean, I just think there's a lot of talk, and obviously there's a lot of stuff going on in the country right now as well. A lot of attempts to dismantle unions and a lot of unrest over how things are being done. And, you know, there's a lot of back and forth on the whole healthcare reform that's going on. I do believe there's a provision that goes in 2012 where more people are required to provide healthcare, which might help expedite things. But it's still, the bottom line is what the industry has created in California, especially in Los Angeles, I should say, is a freelance itinerant workforce where people come on, work on a film for, you know, 6 to 12, 18 months, and then go off to someplace else and work. And if you have to start over every time on minimums of your health care and waiting periods and start a new plan for your retirement account, and it's just very inefficient, messy. And, you know, when somebody gets a gap. Sometimes these shows are so draining. You know, you're working so many hours on a show, and then boom, you're off work for a month or more, waiting for the next thing to start up because everything doesn't always time out so beautifully. Well, now you've got to pay for that healthcare, you know, and that's very expensive, the way our system's set up. So, I mean, I just don't see how it's sustainable, because you just can't have a workforce that, you know, if everybody's busy all the time, it's great. It all works out pretty well, I guess. And they're paid well, it works out. But, you know, entry level, it just, for me, the whole thing is not sustainable. That's my bottom line here. And I have not heard any solution yet that lead to anything beneficial to the artists other than what we know works for our brethren on set.
Yeah. Ironically, though, as we're going to be discussing in an upcoming VFX show here on FX Guide, that visual effects aren't in decline. I mean, we're going to be discussing independent films now giving heavily into visual effects with things like Tree of Life and Melancholia and stuff. And so in this environment of what I'd have to say is a pretty depressing picture of kind of, you know, no one makes any money and everybody is, you know, sort of running poor. There is a lot of money spent on visual effects. And I don't actually think it's going to the owners of the visual effects companies either, because I don't see, like, you know, the actual companies themselves, you know, having vast cash reserves and making obscene profits. So it's a problem that, while you're approaching it here, obviously today from a labor point of view, probably has even further wider-reaching implications into how the whole industry itself, even at the corporate level, manages to get a better cut of the obviously vast amount of money. And I'm literally, I mean, like, sometimes the largest line item on a budget is visual effects, and yet those that are doing that work, you know, and normally you'd say follow the money. Normally, you know, the Wall Street model is wherever the flow of money is, tap onto that, and you'll get points off that and you'll be happy. But in this industry, it seems like no matter how many tens of millions of dollars you're assigned in a budget, it seems hard pushed to make any money, nor for your artists to, you know, have any kind of upside if the project goes well.
Well, and it's not even in the case of a lot of the stuff we're talking about, it's not even really within the purview of a company, an individual company, to be able to solve, because sure, they could bring somebody on, they could provide them healthcare, they could give them vacation days, sick days, things that we expect are not part of the normal in Los Angeles and in this marketplace. Now, look, people make money. There's people making good money doing visual effects. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of people that would laugh that people are even complaining about any of these issues. But the fact is, you know, all it takes is one hiccup. All it takes is a medical problem that takes you out of work. It doesn't take much for the whole thing to collapse. And that shouldn't be the case. It shouldn't be the, you know, if the visual effects companies all individually even stepped up and provided, you know, sick days, vacation days, benefits, stuff like that, it still doesn't help you when that job, you know, wraps and you move on to the next job at another company. So it's a tough problem. I get it. But like, I agree with you 100%. I mean, I mentioned in the podcast with Tom that, you know, if the union wants to really make a difference with these meetings, they should have them across the street from the studio so people can look across the street at the gleaming buildings and go, hey, somebody's making money here.
All right. Well, enough of our chatter. Thanks for that background setup, because it is important. And, you know, let's face it, I myself find it a bit confusing as an outsider looking in, though I do think you're right in saying that many of the issues here in different forms apply to different markets around the world. Let's now go to your interview that was recorded, a couple of days ago?
Yeah, Friday, I think. Last week, yeah.
With Tom Walsh, who, as I said, is from the Art Directors Guild.
Well, thanks for joining us again, Tom.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
So we last talked in April of 2010, and I'm going to first start off by recommending that people go and listen to that podcast. If they'd like we really covered a lot of ground. I don't know if you've listened to it again recently, but I listened to it last week and we covered a lot of ground just talking about the whole issue of labor unions and, you know, evolution. And it was really, I was really happy with the conversation last time, but I wanted to get back in touch with you now just to talk about Previz, because I know that's an area that we talked about even back then that you guys were starting on. And then also the latest thing, which has been the latest thing that's kind of caught my attention is the Bat Painters. You guys are looking at that. So, you know what? I want to start out, though, first. I know we talked last time and you described yourself as a narrative artist, but I was just kind of curious if you could walk people through kind of what you do, like on a show as a production designer. Just, I think it'd be interesting for people just to understand a little bit more the kind of the depth of all the stuff you're involved with.
Right, right. Well, I mean, production designer is basically an overall term for someone who's entrusted with taking the words and guiding them into the proper images that, you know, speak as much to the emotion of the story as opposed to the literal visual story. I mean, we're there to put visuals to words. And in a perfect world, you're hired early on and you come in at the beginning, break it down with the writer and the producers and the director. Unfortunately, it's not a perfect world, so it's not like we all start at the same time. And a perfect situation would be where the cinematographer and the director and the designer would all start with a text that's, you know, created, that's written, and is ready to be produced. That's a perfect situation. I think probably that scenario rarely happens these days. But we're all, you know, but anyway, you're hired at the beginning to do the, in essence, to pre-visualize the story and try and make the right choices so that as you ramp up to full production, you have the information that you need to hand off to an art director who's more the administrator these days of the process. Production designers should be, in the best of situations, be working pretty much in close coordination with the director and the writer in terms of evolving the story. And then art director would come on, and then the set designers will come on, and illustrators will come on to help form the complete visualization of the piece so that you can then put it into the production workflow. But, you know, these days we're dealing with two very different paradigms. We have the, if you just take stock in the kind of films that are being done now, you have everything that's like $12 million and under, and you have everything that's $100 million or more. So we, like the middle class, we're seeing the middle class squeezed out of production. And we're finding two sort of consistent working models, one which is very cheap with high expectations, but not a lot of support to do it. And the other where you have the mega tentpole pictures, which have, you know, huge departments and huge budgets and literally hundreds of people. And I think we're all, as, you know, filmmakers having to come to grips with that new reality is how do we crew ourselves for the productions where we all have to do everything together, and the other ones where, you know, they're much more systemized with different people assigned to specific tasks, because not only does the work require it, but also it's the volume of work and you need those additional hands on deck to get it through. So it's an interesting time that we're going on, and it's a frustrating time for anyone that really cares about what they're doing and trying to adjust and remain relevant as well as remain employed, because more than ever before, we're seeing incentive chasing at a new extreme. I mean, I know that is a real issue for the visual effects community, with companies having now satellite offices from Mumbai to Shanghai to London to the Eastern Urals. God knows, you know, anywhere they can find people that know how to work computers, they're all of a sudden setting up offices and kind of figuring out how to do it with whichever combination of practitioners to get the job. That hasn't happened to the art department yet, but, you know, the new century is still very young. Our concern obviously is always is to keep our members employed and relevant in the projects wherever they're happening. The art directors actually have a unique situation within the guild in that we have national jurisdiction for what we do, except for in New York City. Everywhere else in the country essentially comes under our contract with the producers. So if it's a formal union production, there is an obligation to hire our members wherever possible, at least in the production design and art direction end. Everything else becomes pretty much open territory to who's available in the local regions to staff your productions. There you go. So it is interesting and scary times for everyone involved in doing what we do. And we share that angst.
Certainly. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of we just finished doing a podcast about and a lot of reporting on the movie Hugo, which was,
right,
you know, was done, you know, at a lot of locations around the world, mostly through one company. But you know, the phrase that I keep hearing, even at Visual Effects Society production summits and things like that, is that 24-hour clock and using the global clock and all that kind of stuff, which is very possible in the visual effects world, where we can actually, you know, you can take advantage of the fact that there's people working all over the world on your film to speed up the process. And that's what it really comes down to. It's not in some cases it's certainly chasing incentives and chasing lower labor costs, but it's also being sold now as the, you know, the 24-hour clock and getting the film done faster, which is happening.
But I guess broadband and satellites is the worst thing to happen to us, huh?
Yeah. Well, when we talked last too, the there was a long list of crafts that you had mentioned. I made a little list of like art director, production designers, illustrators, storyboards, concept, mat, set designers, model makers, scenic artists. And, you know, I look at that list, I think, okay, well, that's pretty much, there's so, like you were saying, the lines are so blurred. And the lines between those descriptions and visual effects, I mean, certainly Previz is a classic example of that. I mean, we oftentimes work very closely on the visual effects side with Previz artists. Oftentimes external companies, sometimes internal companies. It just depends on the project. And the Previz kind of, we talked about this last time too, that, you know, you can oftentimes split screen the final film to some sequences of the Previz. It's that involved these days.
I mean,
in Hugo, they were doing 3D Previz. I guess that's not too uncommon these days even.
No, I mean, the technology exists you know, except for the fact that the final visual. I love Hugo, by the way.
For disclosure,
I'll say as a story, I love it. And then obviously, it also deals with Georges Méliès, which we all, you know, any of us who love film, especially the fantasy of film, he was our first parent that got us, you know, captivated about doing what we do. But you know, it still comes down to a delegation of responsibilities. Something that I think I've mentioned to you was the fact that there's this, sort of the dark ages after we'll say that the studio demise in all reality was with the selling off of all of MGM's assets in the early 70s, which pretty much was the beginning of all the studios selling off assets and closing down what remained of their on-lot services. So from that time, you know, I always look to like Star Wars and George Lucas essentially reinventing the wheel and recreating the those units, those departments that used to exist on the lot in independent warehouses in the valley to make his movie, and sort of recreating how it used to be done when I wasn't around then, but when it all happened within the campus of a studio lot. And from that point to now, quite honestly, has been the generation of independent contractors who, you know, divide up the work. However, and now, as we're talking about, it's even getting crazier than ever before in terms of dividing up the work and assigning it to subcontractors, wherever they may be on this planet or another, to do the work. The reality is, I mean, the art directors, because we are union, a part of the IATSE, and we ourselves have gone through some growing changes with the merger that just happened three years ago between ourselves and the Set Designers Guild and the Illustrators Guild. And with those mergers, we assumed contracts that historically were theirs. For example, with the illustrators, the mat painters, they've always represented them. But it was an area that essentially was not organized, has not been organized for many years. They kind of allowed it to go fallow. So as the independent groups were formed, the independent shops to do most of the visual effects, when we were in truly a linear workflow where it was a beginning and a middle and post-production was at the end, everything became balkanized, and that's the way it was. And unfortunately, for the generation of matte painters who essentially are not glass artists, but, you know, are digital artists, they were neither courted or did they realize that an option existed for them to be represented. So we're kind of trying to wake up the dragon here and say, you know, you do have rights. You do have access to representation that you may have never thought you had. And we're willing to try and be your ally in getting what is actually contractually yours to get.
Well, let's talk about that. How does that specifically work? Because certainly, just jumping right to matte paintings, I mean, certainly, you know, ginormous hunks of visual effects films are being done, and a lot of it is matte paintings. I mean, Hugo, the train station was completely built with, there were green walls in every direction.
Yeah.
So the main core was built, and that's not uncommon, you know, and you look
right.
at TV shows like Pan Am, where, you know, the virtual production is really
right.
ramped up and at a high level and very quick turnaround.
Right.
So, I mean, it's really deeply embedded now in the visual effects world. So
yeah.
how do you go after, you know, obviously the big, none of the small visual effects companies are unionized and none of the big companies are unionized. So how
no,
do you
I
actually
know.
Attract? Yeah, obviously, you know, but I mean, how does this work? I mean,
you just have to, in this case, I think it's pretty much a bottom up kind of thing, because we've tried, especially on the previous side, we tried reaching out to the individual companies. And it wasn't essentially we've got a cold shoulder because it's not in their interest to have their businesses organized. They do, you know, profit off of the markup they charge and all the artists that work for them. And so and there is that paternalistic, and I respect it, but it that thing where we do take care of our own. So they really don't need to be organized or in a union because we do give them benefits or access to you know, health and whatever. But
is
I think
it's the case, though. I have not heard.
I don't know. You know, it's different with different companies. They will tell you that. But even if they do, in the best of circumstances, none of those benefits are transportable. So when you're done
right.
with the project and you're laid off, you stop. Accruing the advantages and the contributions that you would be getting. So you know if you go to work for another company, then you're kind of starting over.
Right, absolutely. No, I mean, in the visual effects side, that's the thing we've been harping on when we discuss this, is the fact that, you know, we are considered, you know, a freelance crew by everybody pretty much in town. I mean, there are certain core staff people, but the bulk of the crew is freelance, and there are no portable benefits, no portable health care, no portable 401k.
Right.
In the case of a lot of times, people are being classified as 1099 workers, which, besides being wrong, is also they're not getting paid on time. You know, they're not,
right.
the company's not obligated. I mean, I hear horror stories about people being 90, 120 days out on getting paid because there's no obligation on the company's side other than you can sue them for not paying you on time, but with a paycheck, you are obligated to be paid every X amount
right.
of time.
Right. And that's awful too. You work an 80-hour week and you don't get your check for 120 days.
Right.
That's a nice way to make a living.
Well, it also puts you at big risk. I mean, we've seen examples of this.
Sure.
The Journey to the Center of the Earth people, for example. I mean, where the company just keeps saying to you over and over again, you know, oh, we're going to pay you. Don't worry. Just keep working. And it's like, you know, if you don't have somebody or some organization strong enough to stand up and say, no, we get checks or we don't work anymore. It's very hard for the individual to do that because in some cases, like in that case, there were a lot of people there who were out of their own country working on the film. And so
right.
what do they pick up and leave and never get paid? And, you know, I mean, it's very complicated and messy. And then you've also got the problems of, you know, no vacation days, no sick days. I mean, the number of times, you know, I've seen people working when they should not be working because they have no sick days because they're freelance.
Right, right. No, the workers easily get exploited in these situations. You know, the problem that, again, we're coming to grips with it now, is when we were in a linear workflow, which is we prepped the show, we shot the show, and then everybody went away and it went to post to have being reinvented to a certain extent and then be finished. But now with the condensed delivery and the fact that we're all kind of working concurrent with one another, you know, Previz, which was a tool developed primarily to figure out what the shots would consist of so they could budget them and they knew what they were making before they made it, is now a tool that's not being used as a post tool exclusively. It's now being used as truly a pre-production tool in order to visualize the project and essentially sell it to get the green light. And then based on a pattern, a model that's created in pre-production, you are then extrapolating that information and taking it through the workflow process, of which, as you know, a lot of that work is now happening concurrent with the shooting. It's not no longer all tidy at the end where they take over and finish it.
Yeah, we all hear those stories of scripts that aren't even finished before the movie's shooting. So
yeah, so you know, and
it's all happening at the same time sometimes.
So because of this, you know, again, it's harder for the independent shops that provided the visual effects services to kind of hide in the shadows of post, because everyone's being essentially, you know, integrated from the get-go. And, you know, that's where, again, our organized standing contracts have more validity, because we say, well, wait a second. You know, you can't have a lesser paid individual in the trailer next to mine visualizing the story that then I have to, you then hand off to our production designers and illustrators and set designers to take to a certain level for in camera shooting, and then take that same information that was generated before they started and then leapfrog over them to the post visualization and realization process. You know, it's not tidy anymore. It is everyone's on top of one another. And so the best that we can do, again, is essentially say, all right, this is the way you want to make your movies. You understand that we have these contracts with you, and you have to honor them, and you have to treat people in a fair and appropriate manner.
But those contracts aren't with the companies, the visual effects companies, for example.
No, they're with the producers, but the producers are writing the checks.
Right. So, but you know, I mean, the producers, I can't imagine, can go to the visual effects companies and say, you now have to use union workers. I mean, then they would not want to do that, I would assume.
No,
so how does this actually work? I mean, let's just say that, you know, I mean, how do we get past this? How do you actually make this happen? That's the question, I guess.
Well, again, it's bottom up. We have to start getting members who actually, or we have to be making members out of individuals who don't think a union opportunity ever existed for them without going through the catch 22s of, you know, how do you get into a union, and employing the workforce that's most employable. Quite frankly, it's kind of a rising tide approach. The irony of this, of course, is, you know, usually to get in a union, you have to pay a significant amount of money as your entry fee to become a member of that union. I like to be an art director. It costs up to $8,000 to become an art director. That's your initiation fee, which is based on a percentage of income that you would make over a short period of time. Mm-hmm. But with our effort at trying to do outreach to practitioners, whether it's Previz or digital matte painters who are working in what is our jurisdictions, we're waiving that. We're saying, you know, we don't want your initiation money. We want you to be, you know, a valued member of our workforce. So we'll waive that, come on board. And then, again, if you get a certain percentage of those who are the most employed or the first employed, then we as an organized group have a stronger lever and argument with the producers in terms of, you know, how they hire these people and how they compensate them. And essentially the same thing with the company. If the people that they most want to hire, who they know are the most creative and productive to their end effort, are members of the guild, then they'll have to treat them in a different way than they would if they were, you know, divided and conquered as they are now.
So is there education, outreach? Frankly, even especially, I know you can't speak for visual effects, and that's a whole other topic, but with the number of people, the number of physical bodies working in visual effects, I'm kind of stunned that you can drive down the streets of Los Angeles and not see billboards to visual effects artists, that you can't see people standing outside of visual effects artists. You would think that it would be in the IATSE's, in all the unions, best interest to gather this gigantic group of people in just Los Angeles and San Francisco alone.
Yeah.
And get them into bars and talk to them and get them, you know, educated. And they won't even do a podcast. So, I mean, I know that, I'm not talking to you about that, but I'm just, no. It's the same kind of thing. I mean, how do you reach out to these people? I know you guys have put up a website and have put some information on there for both Previz and matte painters.
Yeah. And that's a website. It's directactionartist.com. And that's constantly being upgraded and updated. So it remains current and relevant to the moment. But that's really the best first place that anyone that's curious can go to find out what options exist for them, what benefits and would exist for them by being organized. I mean, there is still this negative perception that the union has is that it's basically a bunch of fat cats and, you know, lounge chairs, you know, worrying about their weekend on, you know, on Lake Mead. It's so not that, you know, it's basically, you know, your neighbors and your partners, the people that you work with, just being treated fairly and getting a fair wage for their time and their talents. And again, there is a perception of why do I need to belong to a union? Well, just, you know, you work an 80-hour week and fight to get your paycheck and not have any benefits when your family or somebody gets ill. And it explains itself. I mean, what more do you need to say? You have rights as a member of this industry, and especially on the visual side where, you know, we're creating true value in the, you know, it's always crazy with the studios because they, you know, on one hand, they want to give you nothing and they expect everything in return. But at the same time, they keep reporting each year record profits. And you go, wait a second. Okay. So there's no money to be had, but you keep talking about you're making more money than ever before. Mm-hmm. So there's a disconnect here.
Yeah. I came home the other night. I drove by one of the studios on the west side, and I said to my wife that, you know, if they want to start having meetings with artists, they should have them in the park across the street from the studio, because if you look at those buildings, you just go, you know, there's some money over there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there is.
And the same thing with, you know, it's like I've been to many of the union offices and met with a lot of people. You know, I've met with Stephen Poster over at the ASC, and I've met with the Animation Guild several times. And, you know, I would say get in your car and go and compare the cars in the parking lot at those organizations versus the cars in the parking lot at your own company.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, you know, it's, that perception is totally wrong.
No, it is. And, it, you know, and again, it's all we can do is put the information out there, continue to in our own persistent way, keep reaching out and keep reaching out until enough people start to get the message and take the invitation, quite honestly. It's ironic. For the people that do what we do, it's never been an easier time to become a member. And we're trying to make that clear, that if you're doing a valued service, which is part of the realization of the visualization of a movie, and you fall within the definitions of the services that we provide, that the producers recognize, then you can actually have representation. You can have access to those things that, you know, I'm a strong believer in the VES's Bill of Rights. I mean, what's to argue with that? It's common sense, and it's fairly deserved.
Yes. Although I will point out that I went to their website the other day because somebody asked me a question about it, and I couldn't find them on their website. So it's kind of like, hey, I did find them on FX Guide, of course, but made me laugh. Well, I think one of the things, I think we should talk about a couple of misperceptions. Like, for example, one of the things I've heard people say is, you know, well, we get the 50% of the cards or whatever it is, 51% of the cards, and, you know, boom, it's done. But that's really not the case. I mean, that gets you the election, and then there's another vote, correct? That's how it would have to work?
Yeah, and I'm not really the one to speak to the specific mechanics of that. Because I don't want to misrepresent or misinform. The truth is yes, you get a certain percentage. I mean, the employer cannot deny them the right to organize. That's just, they have that right.
I guess what I'm getting at is I get the sense that even if you get 51% of the artists, I mean, not only does the message have to get to the artists, the message has to get to the artists in such a way that they're willing to walk out to get this to happen. Because I don't think that it's going to happen without that happening. Am I right in assuming that that's how it happens?
Well, you know, I think that's all of our mutual maturity. You know, you realize the one thing you have of most value is your own talents, and unless you're willing to walk out in a situation that you think's unfair, you'll ultimately be capitulating to a situation. I mean, you do have the power to say no. And the truth is, you know, we're dealing with all sorts of different size companies. You've got companies that may have five people, and you may have other companies that have 500 people. So each situation is somewhat unique to that particular place that you're working. The truth is, as we know, none of these companies have any loyalty to any of the workforce other than sort of the key partners that are the profit sharers in the companies. So, you know, ultimately they depend, and it's a rather cynical thing. I think they depend a lot on a disposable workforce, because there's a certain thing that says, well, we'll get another tech head that'll come in that's just graduated from high school or college and wants to be part of this industry. So if they get uppity, we'll get the next crop and we'll train them. Well, you know, it's expensive to train people, and especially on these sort of delivery dates when you're fighting with subcontractors in you know, Vancouver or Mumbai or Shanghai or wherever. So you do have I think a lot of our workforce, or the workforce that we're reaching out to, has, you know, a stronger bargaining position than they give themselves credit for. But unless they're prepared to actually take a stand, you know, we can't help them if they can't help us help them, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And the first step is to say, you know, I want to be part of something that gives me recognition and treats me fairly. And then, you know, essentially, it's a partnership that makes a change. It's not one individual or two individuals or one union doing all the heavy lifting. We have to lift together. It's not going to happen just because the IA or our guild wills it to be. It just, you know, our power comes from the strength of our membership, and it comes from numbers, quite frankly.
Right, and that, you know, and frankly, it's the same thing on our side. In both the individual category of visual effects artists and also as the craft of visual effects, I've been saying this pretty vocally for a while now, that, you know, as individuals, when you're being mistreated, it's really hard to stand up for yourself. Yeah. As individuals, when the checks stop coming, it's really hard to stand up and walk out the door. As a group, the company has to pay attention and has to respond. And that's really hard to do unless there's some sort of structured organization. Same thing with visual effects. Visual effects companies have to be in a position where they can talk with each other, or the business itself has to be cohesive and not willing to tear away at each other to be the lowest common denominator. And otherwise it's just a continual slide. And it's all the business, not just visual effects, but, you know, it's the same. It's not a mystery that solidarity is the way to go. It's just a question of, you know, how to inform and how to get the message out to people in a way that gets them passionate enough to understand it. And, you know, I chalk a lot of it up to the age of the people involved.
Right.
I chalk it up to, there's certainly been an anti-union sentiment in this country, although I certainly think that's being exposed a little bit now, these days,
right,
for being incorrect. I was kind of stunned. Somebody posted a statistic about how many union workers there were in the United States, and it was an amazingly low number. I was really surprised.
Yeah, you know, I think the 80s and 90s took its toll. I look at, you know, the field of people who are running and the Republican side right now, and I just say, all right, how many of them have actually built factories and created jobs in the United States? Even they're all talking about creating jobs. You know, you want to know, all right, how many of you actually built a factory in the last 20 years in this country and promoted work inside? Or has your profits and your wealth been made by, you know, exporting everything? So,
right.
I mean, ironically, motion pictures is still one of the indigenous industries that we have, though it is fragile, especially as we go ahead, that is still, you know, an English-speaking American enterprise. But, you know,
I would have to say culturally, it's been our strongest export.
It has
been. It's definitely changed the perception of the United States over the years. I'm sure that it culturally, when they look back historically, it'll be certainly one of the most influential things we've ever done.
But we also take it for granted, and not just, I don't mean we, but I do. I mean, in terms of both the industry that supports it, and just look at the state alone. Our state completely takes it for granted. Otherwise, we wouldn't have to fight so hard to get what little support we can to keep, jobs and productive, well-paying, taxable jobs here in the state of California. I mean, Louisiana is the largest production center in the country right now. followed close behind by New York and New York City, and then Vancouver and Montreal and, you know, and Toronto, as we know. And then you go offshore. We really have a lot to lose in the short term and more importantly, in the long term, if we don't start working in a more cohesive manner. I mean, I'm not so worried about, you know, it's too expensive there, so we're going to take all the work abroad, because until the studios actually diversify, that is, their production centers all move to the Caymans or wherever else, they're going to be continuing to work out of Hollywood.
Right.
I mean, and that's where they're going to want to view the end product, and that's where they're going to want to make all their last-minute changes. And even with broadband and satellites, the studios are going to want to sit on the final work. So, you know, it's we all have to work and be looking at the future with a couple of doors packed. I mean, a couple of bags packed by the door, prepared to go wherever they're going to send us to do what we have to do. That's just where we are now, and it's not going to change in the short term, unless there was, you know, a social or upheaval in some place in the world that forces everybody to run to cover and come back to home.
Well, it's also the fact that people aren't paying attention. I mean, there's so many of these studies that have been done on these incentive things that basically, I mean, Louisiana may be the biggest production center, but I'd like to know exact numbers of how many of those people are from Louisiana working on those shows.
Oh, very few. I mean, it's a very fragile workforce, you know, and it, you know, you can go there for the incentives, but you end up having to import more people, or more people have to become local residents in order to support the work. Oh yeah, we all do. And the thing is it's both cynical and very cyclical. I don't see that as being the long-term solution. It's just we're dealing in an industry that thinks by quarterly returns. There's no long-term investment anymore in infrastructure. Though I say that, and I also have to applaud ABC for actually expanding their backlot facilities. After everybody else is selling off facilities and shutting things down, they've actually made an investment thinking production is going to remain in California, or hoping – or banking that production will remain to a certain extent in California. So they've actually invested in expanding their local production potential. So, you know, that's to their credit. And, you know, little things like that always give one hope. You know, you go to visit some of the younger companies here in town that are actually making capital investments with the thought that to a certain extent, production will remain and require the services of whether it's flooring or digital wall coverings or whatever. I mean, I don't think it's a completely cynical outlook, but again, I think unless we take a proactive and constructive approach to the situations that we're all faced with, it can get bad. It could get bad, but I think we do have the power to make a difference if we really want to do that.
Well, and the problems that exist with workers in California, where this labor stuff tends to be more focused upon, are the same problems facing the workers anywhere in the world and anywhere in the United States, of course. You know, and they may not come to a head as fast, but, you know, those problems will continue to bubble up and, you know, they're going to be facing the same problems. So it even makes more sense even, you know, nationwide for everybody to be kind of organized and together, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, again, your rights are exportable. You can take them with you if you're a member. And if you're hired under a contract negotiated with the studios. So, you know, the fact is, again, we're in an industry that does value talent, even if it doesn't want to pay for what it's worth. With the compressed deadlines of production on all sides, from fabrication to final deliveries, you can't do that with kids just out of school or numbskulls. You need qualified, you know, experienced, talented practitioners to provide those services to, you know, bring it all together. So, we as a tool to that purpose can only do it if the members or if the potential members want to be part of that paradigm shift in how we do business with the studios.
Right. You know? Okay, let me go to another another myth that I think people have, and that I keep, not myth, but it's just something that needs to be explained. I keep hearing people, when they talk about unions, talk about the hiring hall.
Right.
And things like, well, you know, I'm going to sign up with the union, but then a job's going to be coming open and they're going to have to send over the next person.
Yeah.
And certainly I sat in a meeting with IBEW when they were courting visual effects briefly, where somebody asked that question, and I had never heard of that. Because obviously I'm not familiar with that in the normal way we work.
Right.
But, you know, that's obviously something artists are very sensitive about and afraid of, frankly. And But, I mean, it doesn't apply, right?
No, it doesn't apply. You're basically, you're hired on the merits of your own ability and the network you've created for yourself. The union is not an agent. It doesn't pick favorites. It doesn't say you have to hire this person over this person if they're all equally good members in good standing. That's just a myth. We aren't a hiring hall in any way. We do maintain a list of availability that is members who are in good good standing and available to work. And we're constantly trying to figure out a better way to manage that list, because the list is only as good as the members report their availability or not to work. So we're constantly having to refigure out how to make that list better in terms of quick access for producers who call in or for production companies that call in looking for people to provide specific services. But it's a completely democratic process. There's no you have to pick, you know, these guys first. And then the only issue that we say is, you know, our members are on a roster that's maintained by the producers, and they have to be a member in good standing on that roster in order to work. Now, anyone who becomes a member, you know, you will gain that roster status, and you will be able to work whenever someone wants to hire you. So that's the bottom line on that.
Okay, good. Yeah, I just wanted to get that out there, because that is certainly one of the things that pops up from time to time
sure.
when I'm talking to people about these issues. Okay, let's go back to Previz. So I assume none of the big companies have signed on.
No, and I don't expect they will. I mean, just because, as I say, their current business models that they created for themselves really don't encourage them to sacrifice any of their labor markup to provide the wages and benefits that a union contract would require of them. And we've reached out to them and tried to say, all right, let's figure out how we can make this work so it works for everyone. We're not, you know, there's no one person who's gaining at the advantage of another. Because the last thing we don't want to do, because we acknowledge that these individual companies have done a great deal of R&D work to create an industry for themselves. The problem is the industry they've created themselves is a parasite upon what we've always done, especially with them now working in taking pre-production to true pre-production of a show. Pre-visualization to the pre-production end of the show. They're now doing our work and charging, you know, and they're charging a couple of rate, but it's not going to the workers, it's going to the companies. So, and you know.
Okay, so let's assume that there's a sizable number of Previz artists, matte painters listening to this. Mm-hmm. What should they do? What's their role in this, and how important, you know, what can they do that can make a difference?
Well, I would direct them to go to directactionartist.com and do some homework there. And then come up with questions, talk amongst themselves, amongst their coworkers, do outreach to us. We have ways that they can reach out to us that are completely anonymous. So if they're concerned or they have questions, they can voice those questions to us without putting themselves in any, if they're perceived, jeopardy. We will answer their questions to the best of our abilities. There's a great deal of information that empowers them to make decisions on their own. We also have, you know, the famous cards that they can download as PDF. The labor laws require that anyone that wants to be a member, wants to be organized, we have to have a hard copy, so it can't all be done digitally. But they can download those cards and send them into the guild, especially if they're trying to organize within a specific company. There are tools that are online there that they can use, and they can become completely informed about those tools before they go down a road that gives them pause. But I think that's the best thing, is to become informed, don't deal with myths, don't deal with what anyone else tells you. Become informed yourself, empower yourself to make the right decision that you feel is in your best interest. And hopefully it's in something that will help us effective change, because the union is a wonderful tool in terms of being an advocate for the members' best interests. But again, it only works if the members empower it to represent them and to do that. You know, it can't work independent of a membership desire and need.
Now, I could see that on a previs company, for example, working in terms of everybody gets together, they're all kind of in the same world, they're all in the same craft, and they can come to you in a smaller company. What happens if there's a previs department or mat painters who are part of a large company, a Sony or a Rhythm and Hues or something like that? You know, I assume that the whole company has to become a signatory in order for them to be represented.
No. I mean, the truth is we're all freelancers. I as a designer am hired by different companies all the time. And there's a whole structure within the company. If some people are a member of one union or another union, or there are people working in the production office who aren't represented at all. I think, again, there are certain guaranteed rights that, and again, we have the contract is there. It's historic where matte painters are concerned. Forget it, digital or analog. Matte painting is matte painting. And you're just using different tools to do exactly the same thing that they've been doing since the 20s. And, you can look at those great historic photographs where the mat department was just the next door over from the art department. And the roughs and the early concept work was done in one office and walked across the hall and put up on the easel. And the mat artist would then interpret that and turn it into the finished work that would go in concert with whatever was being photographed. So historically, it's always been part of the art department. Again, it wasn't until they shut down the art department and then shut down the visual effects units in the studios that we've all had become independent hunter-gatherers figuring out how to do it from show to show. But they have those rights. We have those contracts. So theoretically, they should have always been the union should have been doing a better job, quite frankly. I'm not going to make any excuses for it. There's a period of time between the 70s and now where they should have been doing outreach to those people providing those services to independent shops or others, because they were doing work that's always been covered by union contracts with the producers. So, again, if you get the people that are most in desire to say, this is, these are my rights and this is part of the deal with hiring me. You have to pay me through my union contract and, make those benefits payable so that I get my PNW and the other contributions that I'm, again, if someone values themselves enough to make a stand and they are that person that they have to hire, then they will do it. But as long as people don't stand up for their own rights, they'll get away with as much as they can. Well, and I'm not saying it's ever easy or it's ever absolutely clean and one way solves all problems. But, again, we're dealing with an issue that has gone unpoliced for so long that it is part of it is much like the question that you had shared with me from one of your listeners who was saying, what is matte painting have to do with the art department? I've never worked with an art department. Well, the truth is I understand that because, as I say, that's that generation where there's been a complete disconnect. But what we're saying to everyone, we have those contracts and they're historic and it's there in writing. So, we can represent you if you want to be represented. We're not participants in the blog world because it's too labor intensive to do blogging. Mm-hmm. But as I say, the directactionartist.com has a lot of information on it, and it's constantly being updated because it's kind of a living thing. It's not just we put it up there and we've walked away from it. So we're continuing to try to make it more responsive and more useful to those who are respective members who want to see if there's something there for them. I'm easily contacted through the union. If anyone wants to contact me directly, I have no problem with that. I'm happy to be a facilitator for information. And as is anybody else at the Guild, in the management, whether it's Scott Roth or John Moffitt, our two executive administrators. You know, we're there to try and answer questions and you know, try and help make a difference.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. Anytime.
Well, thanks for that, Jeff. It is a difficult problem, but then we are a community that comes up with creative solutions to difficult problems. So, you know.
Yeah, here's hoping.
He's hoping.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you are off to one of my favorite things, SIGGRAPH conference, where we often see some of those clever solutions presented way before they're even commercially viable. So tell us a little bit about that. They're Singapore, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going next, actually Hong Kong, but SIGGRAPH Asia, which, you know, has been growing. The reason you probably got Singapore in your mind is it's going to Singapore next year, 2012, is where it's ending up. But yeah, no, both John and myself are going over. You'd be very welcome to join us if you could prize yourself away from LA for a bit, but I know you can't. Yeah, and we're going to be over there for SIGGRAPH Asia, which has some really good stuff this year. And I know a couple of people have actually sent us emails asking for us to do stories on a few of the things that have already appeared, I guess, as things that will be covered. So, for example, there's a really interesting piece on rendering synthetic objects into legacy photos. You may have seen a YouTube clip on that, which seems almost too good to be true. Mm-hmm. And we've been keen to follow up on that. We have an interview on that and others. Lots of fun stuff. Of course, if you're in Singapore, oh, sorry, you got me saying it now. If you're in Hong Kong next week, the week that is SIGGRAPH Asia, please send us a tweet. Come and have a drink with us. Say hello. Do whatever, because it's a small conference. You know, it's smaller than SIGGRAPH. Though we were just at SIGGRAPH Vancouver, and we're back in SIGGRAPH LA next year, right? So LA is your home turf, and that should be a big SIGGRAPH. So that would be 2011. What, August in LA?
I'd have to look it up, but generally, yeah, that's about right. July, August.
Yeah, and then of course it's actually weird because I think we go LA. The off year is Anaheim, which is practically LA, and then it's back in LA again. So I don't think for the next few years we're going to move much out of LA. Yeah, that'll be good. And SIGGRAPH Asia, as I say, in Hong Kong, then in Singapore. I don't know where it goes after that.
I don't know either. Didn't I see a paper? I think I saw a paper. I was really curious to see if you guys saw it, about facial replacements. I think I saw
I have that. Not seen that.
But there's some paper about literally taking two clips of people and putting the face from one on the other. And I'm like, you know, it's the Benjamin Button thing, which is so difficult to do.
Yeah.
No matter how hard you try. And the demos were pretty impressive. I didn't, you know, you didn't get the sense that that was what they were aiming for, but it certainly piqued my interest. So if you see that, check it out.
Yeah, we're also going to be doing a lot of stuff on animation and rendering and stuff. That seems to be two themes that FX Guide's going to be hitting pretty hard. So we're going to be looking at rigging and talking to some riggers, as well as looking at things like RenderMan and Max and Arnold and other stuff, and Metal Ray and V-Ray and all the rays.
Very cool.
So it should be fun. Yeah, so all that next week, we'll obviously put stories on FX Guide. We have some really good FX Guide TVs coming up. We have some really good RC podcast, the cinematographers, digital cinematography podcast coming up, including a run through on the digital workflow behind the Muppet film. Do you ever watch the Muppets when you were a kid?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm dying to see the film. I haven't seen it yet, but I hear it's quite good.
Yeah, I think it looks good too. And so we spoke to Light Iron about the digital workflow on that. And yeah, so a lot of good stuff coming up before we hit our Christmas, where we have a minor break before we come back in the new year. So
very cool.
Guys, thanks so much for your support in listening to this podcast. Jeff, thank you so much for your interview with Tom, and Tom for taking the time to talk to us. Hopefully, we'll be able to continue to touch on this issue as it evolves over time, or rather, perhaps be a bit of a signal for when it hasn't moved over time, which seems perhaps more the case. So on behalf of our partner, John Montgomery, myself, and of course you, Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mike, and have a safe trip. Talk to you when you get back.
Yes, absolutely, man. Talk to you then. Bye.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.